Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Michael Brown reporting. The manhunt continues for the gunman accused of killing 39 people and wounding dozens more inside an Istanbul nightclub during a New Year's celebration. Dorian Jones has more.
Funerals have already begun of those killed in the New Year's Eve nightclub attack, while Turkish security forces are searching Istanbul for the gunman responsible. Prime Minister Binali Yildirim denied initial reports the assailant was wearing a Santa Claus costume and said he left his gun at the scene before escaping. Efforts to identify the victims is continuing along with their nationalities. Foreign nationals are among the dead. The Reina Club, located on Istanbul's Bosphorus waterway, is one of the city's most exclusive venues and popular with tourists. No group has so far claimed responsibility for the attack, but analysts say Islamic State will likely be the main suspect.
That was Dorian Jones reporting. The Islamic State is claiming responsibility for an attack at a southern Iraq police checkpoint that killed 7 people. Officials say gunmen wearing suicide vests and driving a vehicle packed with explosives also wounded several others in the attack Sunday south of Baghdad. All the attackers were killed. North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un said Sunday his country is in the final stages of developing an intercontinental ballistic missile. North Korea conducted 2 nuclear tests last year, undeterred by increased sanctions. Pyongyang responded to the sanctions by accelerating its weapons development program. And President-elect Donald Trump casting new doubt on the U.S. intelligence conclusion that Russia meddled in the presidential election through computer hacking, saying that President Obama, rather, led to him to impose sanctions on Russia of the spy agency last week and expelled 35 diplomats who said were spies. This is VOA News. 2017 brings new leadership to the United Nations with former Portuguese Prime Minister Antonio Guterres taking over as Secretary General. During his first day on the job Sunday, he spoke of the challenges ahead.
On my first day as Secretary General of the United Nations, one question weighs heavily on my heart. How can we help the millions of people caught up in conflict, suffering massively in wars with no end in sight? Civilians are pounded with deadly force.
Guterres has promised to be a bridge builder at the UN. He replaces Ban Ki-moon, who ended 10 years at the helm of the United Nations, saying he is proud of a global climate change agreement and new UN goals to fight poverty and inequality. Police in Burundi say the country's environment minister was shot dead in the capital early Sunday. A police spokesman said in a tweet that Emmanuel Nyandura was killed in Bujumbura while on his way home. The shooting is the first of a senior government official since Burundi fell into political turmoil nearly 2 years ago over President Pierre Nkurunziza's controversial bid for a third term. South Korea's impeached president, Park Geun-hye, held a rare meeting with reporters Sunday to deny allegations that she colluded with her longtime friend, Choi Soon-sil, to extort money and favors from Korean businesses. It was the first time Park has spoken to the media since being impeached by Parliament on December 9th. Park has apologized numerous times, adding she never personally benefited from her 18 years in public service. A fire broke out on a ferry in Indonesia Sunday, killing 23 people. Officials say the ferry was carrying more than 200 people to islands north of the Indonesian capital of Jakarta. Authorities say in addition to the dead, more than a dozen people were injured and more than a dozen are missing. So far, no word on a cause of the fire. The Democratic Republic of Congo political parties reached an agreement late New Year's Eve calling for the president to step down after an election that must be held by the end of 2017. The ruling party had originally proposed that Joseph Kabila leave office after elections in mid-2018. The PAC ends months of unrest, with dozens killed and hundreds arrested over how and when Kabila would leave power after 15 years at the helm of the vast Central African nation. For details on more news, we invite you to join us at voanews.com. I'm Michael Brown reporting in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
There's nothing called genocide. You know, the so-called genocide was being said that it will happen first in Yei, and second Yei is not good. I mean, Yei now, this is a proof that there's no looming genocide in the Republic of South Sudan.
South Sudanese First Vice President rejects warnings the country faces genocide.
In our Nigerian case, the facts speak for themselves. For instance, inside Sambisa, we held Christmas celebration in Sambisa Forest.
Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari congratulates the military for dislodging Boko Haram militants from their main hideout in the Sambisa Forest.
They consider that it's meddling in the internal affairs of a country. Now, in the Gambia, it is like imposing their will in the internal affairs of a country. This is not a good precedent.
And a Gambian diplomat defends President Jammeh's refusal to hand over power. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The South Sudanese First Vice President Tabang Dengai visited the town of Yei following a report of unrest in parts of the country. This after UN experts warned that the country could plunge into genocide if the prevailing conditions are not resolved. For reaction, I reached Tabang Dengai shortly after he attended church service to usher in the new year in Yei.
Your Excellency, Happy New Year.
To you also, Happy New Year to all the people of South Sudan, to the whole Republic, and Happy New Year to Voice of America also.
What is the significance of your trips to hotspots, including Yei?
I'm the first Vice President of the Republic. The first Vice President is for all the geographical location of the whole South Sudan. There's nothing called hotspot. We are working for the stability and a beginning to the whole Republic. We want to move with the country forward.
There are concerns that the country could be spiraling into genocide or looming genocide, as some of the reports have put it.
My being in Yei is a proof that there's nothing called genocide in the Republic of South Sudan. Now, what we are discussing is how to move the country forward, is how to develop the country. Yes, it is true, we have ups and downs, some difficulties on the road, but we are capable of addressing all those issues. There's nothing called genocide. You know, the so-called genocide was being said that it will happen first in Yei, and second Yei is not good. I mean, Yei now, this is a proof that there's no looming genocide in the Republic of South Sudan.
What about the implementation of the peace agreement? Because some people are accusing you and President Salva Kiir of colluding to push your former ally, Dr. Riek Machar, out of the system to thwart the full implementation of the peace agreement. What say you?
How did I push Riek Machar out of Juba? He opted to leave Juba. He opted to fight. He opted to be violent. He was in Juba as a very powerful first vice president. We received him in Juba. We made sure that he takes the oath of office the same day of his arrival. But he decided to be the president in the waiting. He was a parallel president in Juba. He was denying the government the cooperation needed by the people, the cooperation needed for the implementation of peace agreement. He was a parallel president. He had a parallel council of ministers. He was moving with huge forces in Juba. He was intimidating everybody, including President Salva himself. He's him who shot the first bullet in Juba. I decided to remain with my colleague, the leadership of the SPLM in opposition, so that we continue with the implementation of peace. We remain in Juba consciously because we decided to be peaceful people because the option of the country is not going back to violence. People have suffered enough. We are continuing with the implementation of this peace. We want the Voice of America and everybody in the world to give us the breathing space so that we implement the agreement.
What is the status of the implementation of the peace agreement as we speak? Because there are reports of sporadic fighting in different parts of the country.
You know, in any peace, there are spoilers. There are negative forces in the peace. This was the situation during the CPA. It is the situation now. Peace did not come one day. Yes, it is true, we have signed peace agreement. But as we go along with the implementation, there's a lot of details that we need to put in order and in place. It is not true that there's no peace in the country. There's lull all over the country. Yes, there are pockets here and there, and we are addressing this issue. That's why I'm in Yei. We are moving forward. It is not true that there's no peace in the country. There's peace in the country. I'm in peaceful Yei. The government has decided to stand with the people who are for peace. Peace is moving forward.
What should the people of South Sudan expect in this new year?
In the new year, they should expect the more peace, more development, more delivery of services, reconciliation and healing. I think you are aware my president have announced national healing and reconciliation, the dialogue. As I'm in Yei now, we have started with the small peace here and there. I just came out from the church. We are preaching peace. This year is year of peace, year of more talking to the people of South Sudan. And there's consensus that we must maintain this peace, that people must be peaceful and unite the people and reconcile the people.
Even as the president has called for peace, reconciliation, and national dialogue, critics say he never mentioned Dr. Riek Machar, his rival, in name to be part of this peace deal. The critics also say that Tabang Dengai, the now first vice president of South Sudan, was used by Salva Kiir to dislodge and push Dr. Riek Machar out because he doesn't want to implement the peace deal as signed, because he said that he had reservations of the peace deal before he signed. What do you say to that?
No. I did not push Riek Machar out. He decided to push himself out. He decided to fight. I'm talking to you. I'm a peaceful person. I'm somebody who embraced peace. I want stability to the people. Life of the people matter to me. In war, there's no services to the people. There's no good thing to the people. In war, you don't have enough services to the people, because war is crisis. It's that. In crisis, there are injustices. I did not push Riek Machar out. Let him come tomorrow to Juba. And why do you think, don't make your peace agreement because of on personalities. Lack of peace in South Sudan is not because Riek Machar is not in Juba. It's not because Lamar Collins is not in Juba. If they have opted to be outside, we are just appealing to them, be peaceful, so that we have a smooth transition. Come back to the country, come and form your parties, propagate your objective, and let people elect their leaders.
Tabang Dengai is the South Sudanese first vice president. He spoke with me from Yei in South Sudan. Opposition leaders from the Democratic Republic of Congo signed a deal with the party of President Joseph Kabila on Saturday. The agreement requires him to step down after elections that must take place before the end of 2017. Mediators from the DRC Catholic Church had been heaping pressure on both sides for weeks to sign an agreement aimed at averting a slide into anarchy and possibly another civil war over Kabila's decision not to step down. For more regarding the agreement, I reached Freddy Mbuyamu Matungulu, a leading member of the opposition Rassemblement.
I think I can say that we are very pleased with the substance of this agreement. It is, as far as we're concerned, probably the best we were able to put together. Now, of course, the challenge is to make sure that implementation is just as effective. It's important to stress a couple of things about the agreement. First of all, the agreement reaffirms the importance of maintaining the constitution as we know it. The constitution of 2006 is not going to be, during this interim period, any initiative to either change the constitution or introduce a new one. And as far as the Rassemblement is concerned, this is a major achievement. Secondly, consistent with this constitution of 2006, since Kabila is completing his second and last term in office, his board prevented by the agreement from seeking a third term. So he stays in power for a year, because the presidential election under the agreement is supposed to take place in 2017. And then he'll hand over the baton to the newly elected president. There's not going to be any attempt to change that. This is a good opportunity for the people of this country, following this interim period of about 1 year, to make sure that they come back on the path of the constitutional arrangement that was put in place in 2006.
You were part of the Rassemblement negotiating team. Were there any mechanisms put in place in this agreement to ensure each side keep its promise about this agreement?
Yes, absolutely. We have instituted a body that is called the National Council of the Monitoring of the Agreement and the Electoral Process. And this is a major structure that has been put in place, which will be headed by President Tshisekedi. And it's supposed to be made up of 28 people, including representatives from FENCO. And this institution has been tasked with ensuring the proper implementation of the provisions of this agreement. It will be working in parallel or together with the presidency, with the National Assembly, with the Senate. The idea is to make sure that once there is an agreement on the timetable for the implementation of the key actions during the interim period, that this timetable is implemented effectively.
This agreement has been signed. When will President Kabila append his signature to this agreement, despite the fact that his negotiating team has signed? When do you expect that to happen, and when do you expect the Rassemblement leader, in this case Etienne Tshisekedi, perhaps to sign his as well?
I think what was really important in crafting this agreement was the fact that the bishops, at every step of the process of the negotiations, were in touch with President Kabila and with President Tshisekedi. And we hope this can be done very quickly. Sign the agreement. What's really important here is that most of the key elements of the agreement had been checked through with these two authorities.
Freddy Mbuyamu Matungulu is a leading member of the Democratic Republic of Congo's opposition Rassemblement. He spoke with me from the capital, Kinshasa. President Muhammadu Buhari has congratulated the Nigerian military for pushing out Boko Haram from its base in the dreaded Sambisa Forest. This after the military dislodged Boko Haram militants from the Sambisa Forest. For more, I reached Army spokesman Brigadier General Sani Kukashika Usman.
Since 22nd of December 2016, our troops on Operation Lafia Adole, specifically Operation Rescue Finale, were able to dislodge Boko Haram terrorists from their immense stronghold in Sambisa Forest, popularly known as Parisu Kamzairo. And they were not only able to dislodge them, they also occupy that enclave. So invariably, we have our troops now deployed in Sambisa Forest. And the import of that is that Boko Haram terrorists no longer have any base to enable them carry out any meaningful attack anywhere in the country. And we are still in their pursuit. The essence is to rescue all other persons that they held hostage and make sure that we totally eliminate the threat posed by Boko Haram terrorists.
Talking about pursuing the Boko Haram terrorists, there were some reports that while they were running away, they used some women and children as shield. Was this true? Some people are even speculating that they used some of the abducted Chibok school girls. What do you say to this?
Well, as you know, over time, Boko Haram terrorists have been abducting people. And apart from that, if you look at their recruitment system, initially it was basically ideological, but they run out of steam. And nobody wants to join the Boko Haram anymore. So they forcefully conscript people, especially women and children, the most vulnerable of the Nigerian society, and use them either for suicide bombing or shield during attack. So invariably, that is exactly what is happening. And we have enlightened the public about the fact that Boko Haram terrorists, they are in disarray and they can take various forms and shape to disguise and mingle with the society and continue with their criminal activities. But the good thing is that people are becoming more vigilant, people are becoming more security conscious. Those of them that fled and run away to various places or parts of the country are being arrested in piecemeal.
Shekau, the purported Boko Haram leader, came out ostensibly with a video denying that they have been defeated. and saying the militants are strong and they have not been defeated and all that. What do you say specifically to this video countering the narrative that the government released saying that Boko Haram has been dislodged from the Sambisa forest?
First and foremost, if you follow the antecedents of terrorist groups worldwide, they don't give up so easily and they thrive on propaganda. However, in our Nigerian case, the facts speak for themselves. For instance, inside Sambisa, we held Christmas celebration in Sambisa forest. But if you listen or you watch the video clip, he said that there won't be Christmas. But that has come to pass. We did not only celebrate Christmas in other places, but we celebrated Christmas at the heartland of the Hitato headquarters of Boko Haram terrorists, that is Camp Zero. And apart from that, there was a novelty in the sense that all the principal staff officers, all the corps commanders and other senior officers of the Nigerian Army, they went to the various locations where we had military deployment and celebrated the Christmas with the troops on the ground. Be it in Kirawa, be it in Kangaroa, be it in Malampaturi, Damasak, and all other places, and the Christmas celebration was hitch-free. So that belays all his rantings inside the video. And of course, like I said, the facts speak for themselves. Boko Haram no longer constitutes the threat it constituted before. Remember, these were the group of terrorists that coveted territories, sacking not only communities and towns, they even sacked military units. But that is now history.
Brigadier General Sani Kukashikai Usman is the Nigerian military spokesman. He spoke with me from northeastern Nigeria. The Gambian president Yahya Jammeh is refusing to step down and hand over power despite initially conceding defeat to Adama Barrow, the officially declared winner of the December presidential election. Regional Bloc, the Economic Community of West African State, or ECOWAS, has stated that members of the commission will attend the inauguration of Adama Barrow on January 19. To learn more, I reach Samsudeen Sarr, the Gambian deputy permanent representative to the United Nations.
I had a first-hand knowledge of what went wrong and what happened. Apparently, the elections took place on the 1st of December 2016. I was part of the data collecting results. We learned that from our polling stations, the results come in and actually showed that we lost the election. You know, and the president was very humble about it, said that, look, we contested. There is no way we could go around this. You know, this is a rigged proof. Election results were read from the ground and sent directly to us, you know, and looking at what we have as our numbers, these people have won us by 18,978 votes.
Ambassador Samsudeen, what changed? Because the whole world congratulated him for being so magnanimous and conceding and wishing the Adama Barrow, the declared winner, his cooperation to ensure a smooth transition. What changed?
Now, this is what the whole world is missing, and that is because Senegal is going around telling them that nothing changed. But what changed was, 2 days after, we started noticing, people started noticing that the actual numbers that we conceded on and the results published by the IEC, the Independent Electoral Commission, were radically different. That the difference was over 51,000 votes. And then people started asking, what is going on? These numbers do not tally. What we had there and what the AIEC published are not true.
As you initially said, isn't the system set up to be rigged proof because of the unique style?
But then if you know that the system is rigged proof and then the results turn out to be different from what you were being sent, then something went wrong. What was changing the numbers is what drew our attention to it. And we said, look, the numbers have changed. What changed it, we did not know. And the IEC, realizing that people were talking about the difference in numbers, the original and the ones deleted, they went back on the 5th to correct the numbers and brought it down to what we conceded upon and still made a mistake again. Instead of the 18,978 votes,
they brought it down to 19,221 votes, missing it again by 243 votes.
The ECOWAS had been insistent that members of the commission will be present when Adama Barrow is scheduled to be inaugurated. Mm-hmm. Senegal is prepared. There is a standby force to enforce this. What is your gameplay at the moment?
The way I look at it is like Gambia, the president yesterday came out to explain to the world that, you know, with these facts remaining and standing with his people who are in thousands, he's not going to yield. Let them come and slaughter the Gambians and impose Barrow by force, but we're not going to yield. Because looking at something similar in 1993 happened, when the whole world said that Abiola won the elections in Nigeria and asked him to inaugurate himself, nobody in the sub-region came out with a standby force or said, we are going to impose this guy by force. In 1994, he was arrested and charged for treason, and nobody said anything. Now, why do you want to do it in the Gambia? They consider that meddling in the internal affairs of a country. Now, in the Gambia, it is like imposing their will in the internal affairs of a country. This is not a good precedent.
Are you therefore saying that the Gambian army is resolutely behind President Yahya Jammeh, the supposed outgoing president, and that people should be killed for him to stay in power?
No. Like the international community never said it was going to be even free and fair. All along, they were saying that the Electoral Commission is owned by Jammeh. Twice before, in 2014, you remember, December, the Gambians abroad mobilized forces, bought some arms and ammunition, attacked the country with the idea that the IEC could never conduct a free and fair election, so Jammeh must be brought down by force.
Samsudeen Sarr is the Gambian Deputy Permanent Representative to the United Nations. He spoke with me from New York. Meanwhile, Africa has the fastest growing population in the world, and yet it remains the poorest. But experts say young people have an opportunity to transform the continent if provided with the proper leadership skills to serve their communities. Michael Muti is a computer science student at the African Leadership University, or ALU, based in Mauritius. He has been involved in various projects around Africa aimed at empowering the African youth. For VOA, Ruben Chiama spoke with him in Nairobi.
The African Leadership University, simply put, is the Harvard of Africa. And basically what African Leadership University is doing is reinventing, you know, the traditional kind of university education. So it's bringing on a new, fresh approach to university education, making it more practical, where students lead their own learning. And basically the professors become facilitators, because in ALU you're built to become employpreneur. You can be employable and you can even be an entrepreneur. So you get skills of, you know, either being employed or creating your own business and running it.
How did you get to know about the African Leadership University?
I had applied to the African Leadership Academy in Johannesburg, but sadly I never got accepted. But through that, when the African Leadership University was being launched, I received an email from Fred Swanika, who is the founder of the African Leadership Academy. And he invited me to apply for the African Leadership University. And by then, the founding class was receiving full scholarships. And so we are 180 of us, and I was, you know, privileged enough to apply. And out of 10,000 applicants, I was selected and awarded a scholarship to go and study in Mauritius.
Could you tell us a little bit about your involvement in some of these other projects, like GiveOne and other projects that we are involved in?
GiveOne Project is a global leadership organization that basically empowers youth to take charge in their community, to take part in solving the problems they have in their community. And GiveOne Project was founded by a young man by the name Chion Nyang. He's a Senegalese young man who's brilliant. He was the co-president of the Generation 44 campaign. So he actually oversaw the youth that voted Obama into power in 2008. You know, after they experienced a victory with Obama being 44th president of the U.S. in 2008, he saw a way to give back to the community. Like, how will he empower the young people who are struggling to get from the bottom but have a lot of potential in them? So he founded GiveOne Project, which is basically give one person a chance, teach them, empower them, mentor them, grow them.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Juna, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. Happy New Year. Last year, retired Ethiopian long-distance runner Haile Gebrselassie was awarded the Lifetime Achievement Award by the Association of International Marathons and Distance Races, AIMS, as part of the AIMS Best Marathon Awards held in November in Athens, Greece. He was also elected to head the Ethiopian Athletics Federation. And Edwards has more with Haile Gebrselassie.
I'm with the newly elected president of the Ethiopian Athletics Federation, better known throughout the world of athletics as the great Haile Gebrselassie. So many world records, so many medals. If he were wearing all his medals, he'd probably be weighted down to the floor. But anyway, Haile, how does it feel? Your new life. Now you are in charge of Ethiopian athletics. That's a big transition. You've already, for many years, been a businessman. Is this a big change of life for you?
Yes, it is. Now, big responsibility. I'm telling you. Now, every result in what you see, who's behind, of course, Haile. The good result, the bad result, no matter what. Now, everybody will now start to say something. If it's a good, they talk about, you know, just, that's like what he used to do. If the bad result, running and leading, it's not similar. It's not the same. That's what they're going to say. But I myself, I really, you know, just want to put all my effort in Ethiopian athletics. I believe, you know, just can do something. That's what I started. Otherwise, you know, just it's not necessary to become a president or to do something around athletics. But I need some time. Sometimes means, you know, the next 2-3 years.
Of course, we're talking now in Athens, where you're going to receive the AIMS Lifetime Achievement Award. We all know about your achievements. But in terms of, are you thinking of restructuring Ethiopian athletics? Of course, you still have great runners, Kenenisa Bekele, of course, and quite a few very good female marathon runners. But the success has not been consistent in recent years. Are there a couple of main points that you see need to be improved in Ethiopia's athletics?
Yes, I have to. Restructuring is really important. You know, just I keep, you know, just something which one is important for the athlete and which is not important for the. First, you know, I have to check which one is good, which one is bad. After that, you know, of course, I have to restructure. You know, it's not only the athlete themselves. The rule. I have to check again and again. And already, you know, just I found, you know, some of the things, you know, which one is not good for the athlete. It's not good for the result. At the end of the day, you know, what we need, you know, just to win.
Does that also include what I might say as an outsider, a more consistent selection policy? Because there's been a lot of controversy in recent years about who was going to the Olympics, who wasn't, leaving out Kenenisa Bekele from the marathon for Rio this year. What's your view?
Exactly. One of, you know, the issue, as you said, you know, just this election process. I mean, like the selection of the athlete. It was not the things what you need, because, you know, the people who was doing, you know, this thing, they didn't know about, you know, this process, and that's why we paid price. Rio was really bad, not only because of, you know, the performance of the athlete, including, you know, just the things what they've done, you know, before they went to Rio. And that's also one of the things I have to restructure.
Let's finish on a lighter note. We're in Athens. You're going to receive this AIMS Award for Lifetime Achievement. Of course, a couple of days after the award ceremony, there'll be the Athens Marathon. And people already have been asking you, What do you think of this? Is the classic marathon course, the legend of Pheidippides? Will Haile Gebrselassie ever run this marathon? Because you still look very fit. You clearly look like a runner. Maybe you'll always look like a runner. What about that? Are you going to be on the start line one day in the Town of Marathon?
I wish, you know, to run this marathon. At least, you know, just to, I mean, to be at the start line and just to see the atmosphere. And, you know, to run, you know, just a marathon. Of course, I don't promise you, you know, just as a competitor. But as I mean, a fun runner. You never know. We'll see.
Well, I think we'll see that the race of life in terms of you, Haile Gebrselassie, as president of Ethiopian Athletics and a power in world athletics, will continue. Thank you, Haile, very much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Andy. And finally, the Confederation of African Football, CAF, annual awards gala will be held in Abuja on January 5th. This time, there are 8 more categories, as well as the African Player of the Year and Africa Best African Player of the Year. The range of other awards will also be handed out. Continental successes feature heavily in the categories, including nods to Nigeria's Women's Nations Cup winners and Uganda's Gabon 2017 qualifiers. Arsenal striker Osisat Oshoala, who finished as the top scorer with Nigeria at the Women's Africa Cup of Nations in Cameroon, is among us the names on the Women's Player of the Year shortlist. The Super Falcons coach, Florence Amagabemi, is rewarded for Nigeria's triumph with a nomination for Coach of the Year. She will face competition from, amongst others, Uganda's coach Micho, who guided the Cranes to their first Africa Cup of Nations finals in 39 years. Also on that list is Pisto Misomane, who coached South Africa's Mamelodi Sundowns to the Africa Champions League title. Sundowns are also on the Club of the Year shortlist. Other names on the list for an award are Manchester City's Nigerian striker Kelechi Iheanacho, who is up for the Most Promising Talent Prize, and fellow Super Eagle Alex Iwobi, who features in the Youth Player of the Year category. The winners will be announced at an award ceremony in Abuja, Nigeria, on Thursday, January 5th. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent.
Sexy figure, eh? You make me frustrated. Come be my. Cause the way you pull it down, make me want to go mad. Oh my God, girl, the way you grind. Anytime I see you, I'm blind. The way you handle that. Uku!
Oluchi, yes, Oluchi, yes.
Our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. On this first day of the year 2017, as we reflect on the many problems of the African continent, it may be disconcerting to learn that the United Nations, which is of enormous importance to the African states, may be up for some punishment owing to the votes taken in the Security Council last week. The Security Council, by 14 votes to none, with the United States abstaining, denounced Israel's settlement policy in the West Bank of the Jordan, including East Jerusalem, considering them a deterrent to the resolution of the Middle East Palestinian problem. That is to say, the two-state solution, one Jewish and the other Palestinian, which were part of the 1947 partition plan adopted by the General Assembly. The fact that there was loud applause in the Security Chamber when that decision was taken by the Council is a clear demonstration that member states were long time waiting for such a decision. But the government of Israel, in the person of the Prime Minister, Mr. Benjamin Netanyahu, denounced the decision of the Security Council. He complained that the Council was excessively focusing on Israeli policy while ignoring other pressing issues around the world. He said the decision was unbalanced and in many ways anti-Israeli. The more worrying sight for the organization was a comment by the president-elect of the United States, Mr. Donald Trump, who had previously urged the Obama administration to veto the resolution. And after its adoption, he warned that when he assumes power and authority on the 20th of January, the United Nations would see great changes. There have been commentaries and reporting in the United States that it may be that the United States might reduce its financial funding support to the organization. even though the United Nations is such of much importance to African states, it is important for African states not to panic. We have gone through this road before. In the 1970s up to mid-1980s, when the African states were determined to fight colonialism and imperialism as it may relate to Mozambique and Angola, as it combats white minority rule in Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe, and fight for the independence of Namibia, while also combating apartheid in South Africa, many Western countries were disillusioned by the African states, and many governments took some action to reduce their financial support of the organization. The United States, in particular, under congressional resolution, decided over many years to keep a record of all the votes of member states in the General Assembly. And United States financial assistance was based on how they voted. Secondly, the United States withheld financial support for key programs of the organization. For example, they did not finance the Palestine group, nor the apartheid group, nor the group on Namibia. And one key African state leader, Julius Nyerere, once appeared before the assembly, in his last one, in fact, and wondered what would have happened if African states took same position for resolutions which were not supported by the United States and other Western powers. But that went through. And we should also remember what was said in 2003 when the Security Council failed to support President Bush's policy on the war on Iraq. Doom. The United Nations will be marginalized. It will no longer play any role. The big powers, they said, will be acting outside of the organization. All of this did not happen because of the importance of the organization. So there is no need for panic. One must also agree with the president-elect, Mr. Trump, that the United Nations has great potential, while disagreeing that it's a club for fun. The problem of the organization today is the failure of the major powers to reform the Security Council, particularly as it relates to the permanent membership and the use of the veto on the revitalization of the General Assembly to ensure that all member states play a key role. In addition, there is a need to revitalize the Secretariat and particularly to revive the International Civil Service. And in this regard, one looks forward to the new term of the new Secretary General, which begins today, Mr. Guterres, who already has taken some significant decision by appointing three key women to positions of importance: Deputy Secretary General from Nigeria, Chef of the Cabinet from Brazil, and an important advisor from Korea. So these are the things where the African states should continue and not be distracted by other concerns. The United Nations is going to survive, but there needs to be continuing reforms. And these reforms must come from the major powers who today exercise such enormous power and influence in the organization. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. I'm from the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sale, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Jackson Invonganyi, and our engineer for today, Xiao Gang Chang. We say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, the eye of the crow boiled at the new moon brings good luck for the new year. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States values freedom of the press as a key component of democratic governance.
Unfortunately, in too many places, the press has become a target of retaliation by those who feel threatened by freedom of expression and transparency in democratic processes. In its annual census of journalists imprisoned worldwide, the Committee to Protect Journalists, or CPJ, found that more journalists are jailed around the world today than at any time since the CPJ began keeping detailed records in 1990. As of December 1, 2016, 259 journalists were jailed this year, compared to the 199 behind bars worldwide in 2015. Turkey accounts for nearly a third of the global total. Amid an ongoing crackdown that accelerated after a failed coup attempt in July, Turkey jailed at least 81 journalists, accusing them of anti-state activity. In addition, more than 100 news outlets have been silenced. The jailing of journalists continues to be a global problem, with China, Egypt, Eritrea, and Ethiopia as some of the other worst offenders. This year marks the first time since 2008 that Iran was not among the top five worst jailers, as many of those sentenced in the 2009 post-election crackdown have served their sentences and been released. However, Tehran is still stifling press freedom by sending journalists to jail, including filmmaker Kayvan Karimi, who is serving a sentence of 1 year in prison and 223 lashes in relation to his documentary about political graffiti, Writing in the City. The press is too often a target of retaliation by governments that repress freedom of expression and transparency. The United States will continue to speak out for the protection of journalists and for their vital role in open societies and defending the truth.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.